Chief Justice, my name is Justice, Mr. Justice. I may please the court. I'm Brian Bartley. I'm here on behalf of Freddie Flannery along with my co-counsel, Nicole Walker. We are here to appeal numerous convictions from a trial which occurred after a reversal of convictions by this court. So this case involves a retrial. Four of the issues presented involve motions filed prior to trial and rulings adverse to the defendant's request. Four of the arguments involved applications during trial. Is there any particular arguments the court wishes me to address? Or should I proceed?
I wish you to address the ones you think are winners and leave the ones you think are losers alone.
Thank you very much. The first argument that we have raised is the use of three statements by a key Flannery, their out-of-court statements, admitted under the auspices of 11 Delaware Code Section 3507, were based on information provided by third parties and were not based on the personal knowledge of key Flannery, and their admission therefore violated my client's right to confront the actual accusers against him. There was numerous evidence in the record indicated it supported our position. First, the record was complete with evidence that Keith Flannery first learned of the shootings from the newspaper. He then discussed the shootings not with my client. He denied ever discussing shootings with my client, Freddie Flannery, but only with the co-defendant, Corey Twyman. He also said in various locations that he had to go by what he heard. So it's very clear that all of his statements were based on knowledge of others. In fact, if you review the court's order, which is Exhibit 2 of our opening brief, there's only one specific excerpt where the court even made a finding that was based on personal knowledge. And we submit that there, that based on the lack of personal knowledge of Keith Flannery, use of that testimony deprived my client the right to confront his witnesses.
How would you characterize the court's ruling? Why did the court disagree with you?
The court, first of all, the court didn't articulate why it disagreed with us in total. It made specific reasons why it disagreed. It said that on, with respect to one excerpt, 56 to 62, I believe it is, that that was made on personal knowledge. I would submit to the court that if you read the the question and answer before that, it's not clear whatsoever that was made on personal knowledge. It did allow another excerpt, and the next excerpt was allowed in because it was somehow relevant to the saying that both of them shot him. But again, it didn't find that Keith Flannery had any personal knowledge other than the one small excerpt. So I would say that the trial court disagreed with us because it didn't articulate why.
Well, it seems that the trial court took the position that if it's a 3507 statement, whether it contains hearsay or not, it's independently admissible. And since the person who gave the statement is there to be cross-examined, and that you can simply cross-examine them and verify the fact that part of their statement was based on hearsay and hopefully undermine the strength by getting that admission on cross. And your argument, as I understand it, is hearsay wouldn't come in if you were testifying, and therefore your statement shouldn't come in with hearsay simply because it's subject to cross-examination.
I agree with Your Honor's better articulation of our position. In other words, our position is that double hearsay is inadmissible under the Confrontation Clause unless each of the issues are resolved here. It seems that the court here has simply found it to be admissible under 3507 because the 3507 declarant, namely Keith Flannery, was present. But it didn't go to address the issue of who the actual accuser was, namely Corey Twyman. Corey Twyman is someone that this court is aware of, was a co-defendant and was available at least to the state, the court would know, because it affirmed his convictions many years ago. And that person was not called to testify. So, yes, Your Honor, it's our position is essentially is that it's double hearsay. You cannot use 3507 as a way to have double hearsay admitted unless you satisfy both aspects of the hearsay, because it is the right to confront your actual accuser.
Assuming the double hearsay, that those statements should not have been admitted, why is that not harmless error under the facts of this case?
Under the facts of this case, it's not harmless error because nobody saw my client shoot him. My client maintained that he accompanied the person to or at near the scene of shooting. And in this case, it's certainly not harmless error because there's really only two areas of disagreement between Flannery and the state, namely what he intended to do that day and who shot the fatal shots. Now, the state in the first trial maintained that my client shot a revolver, and in this case, nobody had my client with a revolver, so it wouldn't be harmless error because Keith Flannery's statements were not only a brief statement, there were three separate statements that he made August 12th, 1997, statements he made during the course of the first trial on September 22nd and again September 24th. So the substance of the statements, the fact that the state felt compelled to use them, the fact that it implicated my client, and that there was not other evidence sufficient to implicate my client. And my client and the state, in fact, introduced my client's statement where he denied doing it as part of its evidence in case in chief, so it wouldn't be harmless error.
And that would be your client's prior testimony?
That's my client's prior testimony, yes, Your Honor.
Now, with regard to the issue that you raised relating to the transcript of Robinson's statement, do I understand the record to be that at the first trial, you had a cassette, a tape of Robinson's statement and a transcript, and that the transcript was inaccurate, but if someone had listened to the tape, they would have known what Robinson had testified?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that is the case. We were not the counsel at that time.
I understand.
Ms. Mullen was. We only discovered the inaccuracy, though, when we were actually reviewing the transcript from the trials, and we discovered that was there. And I think all parties involved were not aware of that. The state itself submitted as a exhibit at the first trial the inaccurate transcript. This case, the co-defendant went to trial in February, which was about 4 months later. Flannery was still pending his death sentence decision and some post-trial motions. By that point in time, the transcript had been corrected, and Flannery was never made aware of that. Flannery was never made aware of it by the state. When the state says that they tardily disclosed it, they never disclosed it. It was discovered by defense counsel years later.
Did the state know about the mistaken transcription before Flannery's first trial?
Your Honor, I would have to say I have no information that they did know that, so I would say that you would have to presume they did not know that. And there was representation they did not know that, so I would ask the court to rely on that representation. But what becomes critical, though, is not that it's before trial, but in the almost year after trial, the death sentence was handed down, I believe, in either August or September. At some point in time, they had a duty to disclose both to the trial judge, who was then getting ready to make a life and death decision, as well as the new counsel, as well as the defense counsel. There was a pending motion for new trial. This was critical. And the court will recall that in the co-defendant's case, in fact, the jury returned guilty to one count of second-degree murder and one count of first-degree murder. And the counsel in that case made use of that transcript.
I understand your argument. The Robinson statement constituted Brady material.
Yes.
And the inaccurate transcription made that point lost on everybody at the time. And because the Brady material wasn't disclosed, based on the Third Circuit case you cited, they shouldn't be able to use Flannery's testimony from his first trial at his second trial.
Yes, because there must be some remedy. Your Honors, of course, we're conceding that the court should assume that the state was not aware at the first trial of the inaccuracy. But at some point in time, this was a capital case, and before the capital decision was made, they became aware of that, and there must be a remedy for that. And the remedy we ask is that you not use that.
But the statement itself was disclosed. So how do you address the issue of there being an actual Brady violation?
Because of In other words, a copy of the, we understand that a copy of the tape was disclosed.
Right.
For several reasons. One, there was not a Brady material vis-a-vis that the first trial, but there was a Brady violation vis-a-vis the death penalty decision, and that's where our Brady violation we focus on.
I'm not sure you grasp what I think is the import of Justice Ridley's question. Let me come at it another way. If both the tape and a transcript of the statement were disclosed, should the defense have discovered, or was the mistake available to them to discover?
Having not been the defense counsel at that time and not being aware exactly when the tape was disclosed, quite often, you know, the court's rules don't require disclosure until very close to the time of the witness's testimony or not. So ideally, if we had a set of rules where these statements were routinely disclosed, then I would have to certainly concede yes.
Well, hardly anyone has more extensive practice in this area than you have. If there's a written transcript of a tape, do you not routinely get the tape and the written transcript?
Of a witness, Your Honor, as opposed to of a co-defendant or defendant?
Yeah, well,
routinely we get it for defendants and co-defendants, and case-by-case basis we get it for other witnesses, including sometimes all witnesses. And the question is, would I or should I have reviewed that if I had that timely? Yes. And should I, if I was the original counsel at some point in time, review that, even if it's after trial and before the capital decision? Yes. So the question that, but I'm submitting to the court that by February, and well, 6 months before the death decision was made, prosecutors certainly knew about it because the prosecutor then went through the second trial where that was a key point made in that point, which apparently was lost in defense counsel, was not lost in the prosecution. The second 3507 argument we have is that involving Joy Watson, and that the question of interpretive narrative, which has been with the court many, many, many times. But I submit to the court that in this case, the question of interpretive narrative should be answered in the defendant's favor. We have an FBI agent who was in Delaware for about 2 weeks at the time of the statement. This FBI agent was working on a project where they went and interviewed various people. His training is in the FBI. His training as a federal agent is to not make verbatim statements because they then are discoverable in federal practice. Instead, it's to make it interpretive narratives because under federal practice, interpretive narratives are not disclosable. Federal agents do not have the power to tape record statements, and that's what happened in this case. The statement was not tape recorded, even though there had just been in 1 hour or so videotaped statement of a key Flannery. This FBI agent then went and had somewhere between a 35 and a 45 minute discussion, which was recorded very sparsely by some notes.
When you say they don't have the power, you mean FBI policy says they are not to take them?
Yes. In other words, FBI, this particular agent said in his testimony that he had about two or three levels of the chain of command in order to get authority to make a tape recording statement. That's unlike Delaware police agents where 3507 practice is the routine. I've been unable to locate other jurisdictions where we have 3507 practice the way that we have it in Delaware. So I would submit to the court that just that practice that we have in Delaware is rather unique, and this particular agent was interpreting narrative because he's doing two things. He said he's keeping a running dialogue of things that he thought he found important. And when pressed, there was only one set of words of any significance that were put in quotes. The rest of it was not in quotes. And it has to be the actual statement. It doesn't need to be the verbatim statement, but it needs to be the actual statement. And in this case, I submit to the court that the state is unable to explain why, in fairness, it did not tape record Joy Watson's statement when it had just tape recorded the statement of the person whom they were seeking to corroborate. The last 3507 argument that we raise is the issue of given the statutory admissibility of statements pursuant to 3507, that nonetheless is a limited or narrow admissibility. And it only authorizes as affirmative evidence, out-of-court statements with testimony of value. Once that testimony of value is gotten by either proponent, whether it's the state or the defense, they should not then allow to be able to have a second bite at the apple, so to speak, by then introducing a memorialization, be it a tape recording, a videotape, or something else, as significant and to the jury to have, so the jury can be unduly influenced by that. We are an Anglo-American system of confrontation in the courtroom, the jury to observe the evidence, and for so many different memorializations, as happened in this case, to go back to the jury was unfair. Not only they are unsworn to, at the time they were given, they were unconfronted, and we'd ask the court to, as you did in Smith, to revisit decades of practice and find that there's nothing in the statute which requires, once the testimonial value of a 3507 out-of-court statement has been presented to the jury, that requires or enables or allows a proponent to introduce over the objection of the other person, the other party, to copy that statement.
So how would, is that an abuse of discretion issue, or just can't do it ever, that you're arguing for?
That is an abuse of discretion issue with a legal recognition that you can't do it ever unless both parties agree, or unless it's a special circumstance in this particular case that requires admission of the fairness to one or the other side that would require admission of that.
Now you have me confused. It's an abuse of discretion subject to a legal rule. I thought you were arguing that the correct interpretation of 3507 would prevent this from happening.
That's correct.
Would mean the judge erred as a matter of law in admitting it.
That's correct. The error is a matter of law. However, I'm here to argue this particular case. I don't imagine any other circumstance right now where it might be required, but the rule should be that it's not admissible under that statute. There might be, under just trial, general judge's discretion to admit or not admit evidence, but not pursuant, the legal ruling should be it's not admissible pursuant to 3507, because the statute says it's admissible with testimony value. It doesn't say the recording is then further admissible. So that there might be a situation in a particular case where some out-of-court statement, not under 3507, but for some reason, is admissible. But I would say under 3507, as a matter of law, does not authorize out-of-court statements once they've been presented in court. Doesn't.
You recognize, though, that both the state and the defense can use 3507.
Yes, and I started to use that about 15 years ago, and prosecutors were surprised and thought that was their device. But no, the defense does use it as well, Your Honor. And I do understand that. And I believe the analogy with transcripts is a good analogy. The state says it's not a good analogy, but I believe if this court were to rule precisely on this point that you're allowed to allow memorializations of out-of-court, uncross-examined statements to go into evidence before a jury, but not transcripts, that the you're sanctioning and, or would be allowing the transcript of all trial testimony to go in, because Your Honor, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Right.
Deputy Attorney General Gregory Smith on behalf of the State of Delaware. Your Honor, I guess I will try to respond in the same order as Mr. Flannery's counsel presented his arguments here. Beginning with the first issue in this matter, the Section 3507 statements of Keith Flannery. Your Honor, although counsel in opening argument did not specifically mention Crawford, that Crawford was a significant portion of the written briefing, and I believe it deserves some attention from the state in argument here. At issue, counsel has raised confrontation regarding Aki's statements. We're really not talking about a confrontation clause issue as a result of Crawford. As a matter of law, if you have a 3507 statement that comes in, confrontation has been satisfied simply because that witness must have taken the stand. Otherwise, it could not have come in under 3507. So therefore, counsel is somewhat confused the issues of 3507 and Crawford, in particular with regards to the statements of Keith Flannery.
If someone wanted to offer a 3507 statement with double hearsay, wouldn't the court simply redact the double hearsay and leave in what wasn't hearsay?
Yes, Your Honor is absolutely right, and that's what Superior Court did in this case. Motions were presented pre-trial, and all of Aki gave statements on three separate occasions to law enforcement. And Superior Court, in fact, granted part of defense counsel's motion to limit some of the admission of these statements. And then Superior Court also granted the admission of some of these statements, first as admissions by the party opponent, in this case, Freddie Flannery. And then also, although Superior Court in that order did not specifically find part of the 3507 statements to be admissible as statements made by co-conspirator Corey Twyman, that was the issue that the state presented in briefing of the motions in limine. And there's no reason to suggest that simply because Superior Court did not give a 20-page written opinion on those motions in limine, that the reasoning offered by the state in the motion in limine was not applicable.
The state agrees 3507 prohibits the admission of a statement that would include double hearsay. The double hearsay should be redacted.
Your Honor, I don't believe that 3507 is going to then change the basic rules of evidence. This 3507 essentially expanded on the basic rules of evidence that allowed inconsistent statements to be offered by then allowing consistent statements as well to be offered.
Well, you probably know the Delaware statute's pretty unique. It's one thing to introduce inconsistent statements that show they're inconsistent, but we have a statute that specifically says it's admissible as testimonial evidence, like live testimony. So the Delaware statute elevates the 3507 statement to a higher level than simply an inconsistent statement.
Yes, Your
Honor. So my question is, does it come in like normal testimonial evidence pursuant to the statute? And normally, testimonial evidence could not include hearsay or double hearsay.
Yes, Your Honor, that's certainly a fair statement. And that, the state is not arguing that double hearsay. There were portions of Aki's statements made to law enforcement that would have been double hearsay. And the state's position is Superior Court redacted out or did not allow those portions to be admitted. And that the two methods by which Aki's 3507 statements were in accordance with the rules of evidence were admissions by a party opponent, being Freddie Flannery, and statements made by a co-conspirator, Corey Twyman, in furtherance of the conspiracy.
So, are you saying even if the witness didn't hear Flannery make the statement, if the witness heard someone attribute it to Flannery, you're allowed to testify as to what you heard Flannery said from someone else?
Your Honor, if we're speaking of the co-conspirator, then his statements, yes. We're not talking about, I certainly don't mean to misunderstand your question. Here, it's only the statements that are coming in should not be coming in because Aki heard somebody else say something that Freddie said. they should not be coming in that way. They should be coming in because on two occasions, Akee directly heard Freddie say what various statements. That was before the shootings took place, and then on one occasion after the shootings. I believe to reference those A87 and A101 in the appendix. And then, admittedly, the majority of Akee's 3507 statements, which were admitted, are co-conspirator exceptions. That is the basis under which.
Could you explain that one to me? Because wouldn't that have been a statement after the conspiracy was over?
Yes, Your Honor. The general rule is going to be that the conspiracy ends when the, for lack of a better term, the immediate crime of violence has concluded. Your Honor, in this case, the conspiracy, the state's position was still continuing because both initially when Freddie and Corey came back to 24th and Market and were bragging about the crime, for whatever reason, they believed others would be arrested for it. Shortly thereafter, they realized that they were subjects of the investigation, and then both decided to flee. And Your Honor, the state acknowledges that they were not fleeing together. Freddie was arrested at a girlfriend's house, for lack of a better term, while Corey managed to stay on the run for a significantly longer period of time. During a great deal of that time, Akee Flannery was with Corey, during which time he was trying to elude capture and recounted some of the events.
Okay, so I'm missing something, obviously, because you told me that after the crime has been committed, the conspiracy pretty much ends, right?
As a general rule.
Okay, but you're saying that the general rule doesn't apply here because the two of them were trying to elude capture?
Yes, Your Honor.
And they had a conspiracy that continued with respect to escaping from the authorities?
Yes, Your Honor. And then some of that testimony is even reflected in the record by immediately after the crime, when Lionel Moose Robinson is then driving them back, then they stop along the way, deposit the guns in the blue Mazda 323 in the trunk, roll them guns up in the hoodies that they had worn. Yes, they were still acting in concert.
And when these statements were made to Akee, what actions were still being undertaken as part of the conspiracy?
The only action at this point is to evade capture.
And that's an independent basis to say that there's still a conspiracy?
That is what the state is requesting, and the state realizes that that is definitely a departure from the general rule and would not suggest otherwise.
So, just so I'm clear, assuming it was not determined that this conspiracy was still ongoing at the time of the statements that were made to Akee, would there be any other basis on which those statements could have come in?
Your Honor, the state cannot offer an additional reason.
Okay.
At that point. The state would then submit if the court finds those statements not to have been appropriate as a vehicle to come in through the co-conspirator exception. Then the state would, at that point, argue harmless error.
Can you explain the conspiracy to commit what? You're suggesting conspiracy to evade or interstate flight to avoid prosecution, which is a separate crime. Or are you saying it's a continuation of the conspiracy to commit murder?
Your Honor, the state's position is a continuation of the original conspiracy for which they were convicted, the conspiracy to commit murder, and then to avoid capture for that, the commission of that murder.
So that avoiding capture was part of the original conspiracy. That's the inference to be drawn.
Yes, Your Honor. And the state acknowledges that clearly that is not an element of the conspiracy statute, not suggest otherwise to the court. But it certainly was offered as a basis pre-trial. Conspiracy was one of the crimes for which they were convicted at trial, and there at least that there certainly is a factual basis to support the conspiracy conviction, and that conviction has not been challenged here.
Could you elaborate for a minute on why the court could say that it was harmless error, assuming the court finds that it was error?
Yes, Your Honor. Unlike the counsel's statements on the opening argument, there's a substantial amount of evidence to support these convictions, aside from a portion of Akee Flannery's 3507 statements. The suggestion that no one saw Freddie Flannery with a gun, that the record supports that Lionel Moose Robinson saw Freddie Flannery with a gun. That was his testimony. And at where we are on appeal, all reasonable inferences from the evidence are to be drawn in favor of prosecution.
But I thought Robinson said that he had a semi-automatic weapon, not a revolver.
Your Honor, I believe Robinson's testimony is he initially sees the semi-automatic, but when they go to the Mazda after the fact, then he does see the guns. I believe that...
Which gun did Flannery have, according to Robinson?
Your Honor, at that point, I believe he's saying he has both guns wrapped up in the hoodies. I'm not sure yet. I'm not sure that we have Robinson saying specifically Flannery had this gun in his hand.
I thought Robinson's statement was that when Flannery got out of the car before the shooting started, Flannery had a semi-automatic weapon. Is that correct?
Your Honor, I thought that was Corey Twyman who had the semi-automatic beforehand. I'm mistaken, I apologize.
No, I'm trying to understand the record because Mr. Bartley was arguing that part of the problem was Robinson's description of the weapon Flannery left the car with, and that because Robinson's statement was incomplete in the transcript, even though it might have been accurate on the tape, that's what caused Flannery to testify in the first place. And that if he would have known that Robinson was going to corroborate his version of the gun he had when he left the car, he never would have had to testify.
Your Honor, if I may interject into what you said. The theory was that it caused Flannery to testify in the first trial. He didn't testify in the second trial at all.
No, I understand that.
Okay.
We're just trying to figure out now what Robinson testified Flannery possessed when he left the taxi.
I believe he only testifies at the scene one gun. That's my understanding of the record. He only testifies initially to seeing the semi-automatic when Flannery and Twyman leave his car.
Could you continue? Because I assume the fact that Robinson saw Flannery with a gun is not the only evidence that you would rely on to say that this is harmless error, right?
No, absolutely not, Your Honor. There certainly, we have the whole build-up to the crime, so to speak, that basically this whole revenge killing. It is essentially immature young men, in one case 18, in one case 15, who decide to exact revenge from, I think, what's best described as a street humiliation. And I won't back up to through the entire history, but on July 1st of 1997, when Duke Adams and several others are in a car near Flannery's house, they shoot at both Twyman and Flannery. Twyman's in fact shot with a bullet. The shots at Flannery only pass through his clothing. And in front of him, his nieces and nephews that are in a car parked in that area, bullets strike that car.
Okay, so we've got the fact that they've got a motive.
Yes, Your Honor. Then, obviously, we have Joy Watson's statement that also, right there before the fact that they go and commit the crime on July 14th, they announce that let's go do our business. This is an announcement to basically anyone and everyone who's in the vicinity. There's no effort to keep the intent to commit the crime a secret. And that's certainly powerful evidence that they intended to carry out this crime.
Mr. Smith, let me get back to the record. You probably know it better than I do, since this is your case, the only case you're arguing today. As I understand Mr. Bartley's brief, Robinson said both men left the car with semi-automatic weapons. And the reason that's important to Flannery is because one of the victims was shot with a revolver. And Flannery's defense is that someone was returning fire and someone else killed them. Your testimony that when they were putting these guns wrapped up in the hood into the Mazda, that who testified that one of those guns was a revolver?
Your Honor, that was Lionel Robinson who gave that testimony. And, Your Honor, I also believe we have some of the... I guess if I may return to some of the other evidence for why, even excluding a key statement, this would be harmless error. Certainly, the testimony of Dwayne Warren. To specifically talk about what goes down on July 14th of 1997. You have a group of four individuals. Dana, if I'm mispronouncing his first name, I apologize. Dana Adams, Angela Farmer, Dwayne Warren, and Deshaun Scott, who are sitting out in the road near the intersection of 6th and Washington Streets. And they're basically in lawn chairs, and there's also a non-functioning television that's out there. They're simply sitting there talking, and then suddenly they hear gunshots, and then they also see the sparks from guns, and then they realize we're the ones at whom these shots are being fired, and then they take off running. Warren's testimony is clear that there's not return fire. And furthermore, the ballistics evidence at the scene, the shell casings are all located near the alleyway of Wollaston. There are no casings found in other places. This was an ambush. Flannery and Twyman come out of the alleyway and start blazing away. There was no physical evidence to support the theory of return gunfire, and the testimony of both Warren and Scott, who were subjects of the fire, they're not testifying that there was any return fire back. If I may then turn to part of Robinson's statement. It's critical that we're not talking about a Brady violation here. The state turned over the tape to the defense. There's absolutely no factual argument about that. Defense counsel had the tape, and they have an obligation to look at the tape. And as counsel stated in the opening argument, he has no reason to believe that there was any intentional effort on the state's part to leave out part of the transcription. That's simply something that happened. So we're not talking about a Brady violation. Evidence was turned over. Everything was done appropriately in that sense.
What about the point that when the state did realize that there was a mistake, nothing was said to the judge court about it?
Okay, now what we're talking about during the penalty phase of the first trial, that something should have been done sooner.
That's what Mr. Bartley argued.
Your Honor, that I cannot offer a reason why if that was not discovered sooner and then turned over in Flannery's first trial. The fact is,
if that was not discovered sooner. At the point it was discovered, the guilt phase was over, but the penalty phase was not. What was the state's duty, if any, at the point of discovering the inconsistency between the tape and the statement, whether the defense had both or not.
Your Honor, I must confess, I am not fully aware of the timing during Flannery's first trial of when this evidence was made available.
All right, let's assume for the sake of perhaps my irrelevant hypothetical, let's assume that the tape and the statement, which were inconsistent, were turned over to the defense before the guilt phase. The defense nor the prosecution knew of the inconsistency. But after the guilt phase, but before the completion of the penalty phase, the state, but not the defense, did discover that there was an inconsistency of significance. Did the state have an obligation to bring that to the attention of the trial judge, who was about to decide an issue of life or death?
Your Honor, it only seems fair, yes, that that inconsistency should be announced.
All right, assuming that my hypothetical is correct, what would be the consequence for not doing so, if any?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, there should be none, because that first conviction has already been reversed, and we're here on a new trial.
Right, and Mr. Bartley is asking for a remedy that affects the new trial.
Yes, Your Honor.
That would it be, if any?
Your Honor, essentially what counsel has requested is that based on, to accept counsel's position fully would say that this case could never have been retried if you take that argument to its logical extent. And that was not the decision in the first case when this court reversed Flannery's first conviction.
Well, as I understand, they simply don't want you to be able to read Flannery's testimony from his first trial at the second trial. And that's the only remedy they're asking for. And they say, if we'd have known what Robinson's statement actually contained on the tape, Flannery would never have testified. Therefore, at his second trial, you can't use his testimony from the first trial.
And Your Honor, that essentially suggests then that Flannery didn't testify truthfully. If he testified truthfully, there's nothing wrong with his testimony. It's difficult to conceptually understand Flannery's argument that he should have a right to choose whether or not he's going to testify truthfully or untruthfully. I'm sorry, Your Honor, if I may turn to one final point before my time expires. In opening argument now, counsel has asked that this court now essentially reverse decades of its precedence regarding the admission of 3507 statements. One point I specifically would like to address is that the transcripts of the 3507 statements were not admitted into evidence. It was the 3507 statements themselves admitted into evidence. And the effort to analogize 3507 statements to transcripts is unfair. If you were to suggest that the transcripts of the 3507 statements were analogous to basically the the transcripts taken by the court reporter during the course of the trial. That seems to be a fair analogy, but that's not what we're talking about here. Superior Court specifically followed this court's precedent in Atkins, and there's absolutely no reason for this court to set aside that precedent. I appreciate your time and attention, and the state prays that this court affirm Mr. Flannery's convictions and sentence.
Thank you.
Can you help clear up what Robinson's position was with regard to the weapons?
I can, Your Honor. May I refer the court to appendix page 231? This is an excerpt of what his trial testimony was at the trial of the co-defendant, Corey Twyman.
he was asked by the defense counsel in that case where the defendant did not testify. You saw no revolvers whatsoever, did you? No. There was no revolvers involved in this incident, correct? No. So
why is Mr. Smith telling us that Robinson testified he saw the defendants wrapping up a revolver in a hood?
That could be his reading on what might have happened at another time, Your Honor.
Okay. What does the record reflect on, when they were running away and they were wrapping up guns in this hooded sweatshirt or whatever it was, what guns were described as being wrapped up? It didn't.
Question of just guns. It wasn't a question of what kind of guns. Mr. Robinson had 11 years experience as a military officer. He saw the semi-automatic in the front seat held by the co-defendant. He also testified that he recognized what he claimed to be a gun sticking out of Freddie Flannery's thing as being a semi-automatic. And that, I believe, was what the testimony was. And
so he specifically described the guns before they exited his vehicle as semi-automatic weapons. And
yes.
Then as far as seeing them wrapped up later on and being hidden, he described them as guns, but he didn't characterize one of them as a revolver?
No, I do not have that recollection, Your Honor, but I'll review the record when I go back and see whether... There's three transcripts in this trial, and I'll be sure that it doesn't say that.
Great.
Thank you. If there are any other questions, I'd like to sit down. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll take the case under advisement.
Please rise.